Accession number 12149, real 10.
Captain Sutton, real 10.
I started firing at parachutists falling when they were close enough to shoot. That is to say, they were drifting down into the olive grove where I was, and as they were above the trees, one aimed at their feet as they were drifting down onto you and hoped to hit them in the belly. There was a fierce melee as the parachutists landed on the all over the defended positions, and I found that I, once they were down, I couldn't see standing, so I adopted a kneeling firing position, and then there were the boles of the trees, and with the broad spread of the branches above, and you could see the enemy soldiers underneath, so I was firing under the olive trees, in actual fact. A man landed just by me, a matter of 4 yards, and I shot him as he rolled to disengage himself. And at that stage, I heard a shout behind me, and I turned around quickly. And there, outside the olive grove, there was an RAF chap, shouting at me and gesticulating, beckoning. I went out and joined him, and in no time we had 6 or 10 men formed up with me, and 2 more groups formed up on the hillside there. I was the lowest one, my section, and facing the olive grove where the main enemy seemed to be, and then there's a shout from one of the sections up on the hill. They're dropping on the hillside above us, on the left. So I took my section up around the other two, took up a new firing position to deal with this new drop, and we leapfrogged up the hill, as we've been taught by the RAF, by the Royal Marines and the New Zealand sergeants. In fact, it was a repeat of the practice evacuation. It happened. About 30 of us went up the hill that way, supporting each other until we reached the top. When we got up to the Royal Marine gun positions, I sent my section ahead. There seemed to be no Germans there, and indeed it was right in front of the New Zealand and Royal Marine positions, so the problem was certainly we'd been killed if they hadn't dropped out. I went through to see what the situation was, sent my section up ahead to join up with the New Zealanders, and I saw that there was a Ju-52, a German transport aircraft on the airfield. I thought I'd try and take that out with a 6-inch gun, but when I sized it up, I found that in actual fact it was dead in line with that Australian Beaufort's gun position, where I'd had the altercation with the sergeant, and that I'd be firing at full depression over open sights, and so it wasn't really feasible. In any case, we'd been rushing around trying to find ammunition which had been dispersed by bombing and so on. So I then went up and joined the rest of the party. I scrambled under the barbed wire, scrambled along my belly, and got up and joined the rest of the people up on the hill, and we all then were lying facing down, facing outwards, round the, just below the brow of the hill. About 30 of us, I suppose, were up there, facing the airfield. After a minute or so, a Royal Marine sergeant came along and said, "Get over to the back of the hill. This side's well looked after. Enemy infiltrating there." And so I and a whole lot of other people went scrambling over the top and took up firing positions on the other side of the hill. And that's where I spent the rest of the day. I took up a firing position down the slope of the hill facing over to the west, and there was a ridge ahead of me, the valley and a ridge, and I saw a fair amount of action. The Germans closed in on the hill. They actually, in fact, I saw a glider land on the ridge. I tried to knock out the people. I came out of that and I failed. I just was, of course, firing with a .300 First World War American rifle. I'd never fired it before. I'd never sighted it. Therefore, I didn't know how it fired, whether how accurate it was. It's a great mistake. It's one of the basic lessons of my life. And I was trying to do snap firing at running men. The next thing that happened on the rear side of the hill, a file of men in field grey came along, and most of the people on the hillside fired at them. And I thought they were Air Force. I'm pretty certain they were Air Force, because the Germans at that stage, they were in khaki overalls. They weren't in field grey. This is one of the things. And I think that that fire of about six RAF chaps were mown down by our own people. But these things happen in war. German snipers started moving in. And also the Germans mortared the whole of the hillside. They worked up and down the hillside with mortar bombs, gradually stepping up, then stepping across, then down, then stepping across and up. So it did the whole of the hillside, working it over. You could see the line of the bombs coming across, and grabbing your rifle to your chest, you rolled down the hillside, as I did, out of the way of the exploding bombs, and took up a new position. I found myself behind a pack of, a discarded pack of Royal Marine equipment. There was a greatcoat, and there was a Royal Marine's pack, and there were pair of boots. Before that, I had been on the open hillside and I had scooped myself a position, a defensive position, a sort of trench, with my tin hat. Pretty hard spring, early summer in Greece, with the ground hard, and I had scooped out an earth scoop, in actual fact, a small trench with my tin hat. I was only too glad to do this because, in actual fact, I'd been issued with an RAF tin hat. And on the front of it, there was an RAF badge, roundel, red, white, and blue. And I must say that lying there on the hillside, firing at Germans, with a bloody great white circle in the middle of my forehead, I felt like a target on the ranges at Bisley. So I raised the RAF badge by digging using my hat as an entrenching tool, and then things really became rather difficult because the snipers were already moving into the area, and I had a bit of a duel with a fighter, with a sniper, again I knew where he was. He had made a decoy which I wasn't firing at. But every time I fired, he fired back, and I heard the bullets hitting the Royal Marines equipment. It was getting towards the evening, and I knew it was going to be cold up in the mountains, on the hill, and so I managed to pull the Royal Marine's greatcoat out of his pack. That caused two or three bullets into the pack from the sniper. And then I thought I'd have his boots, because I was wearing thin officer's shoes. The sniper wouldn't let me have his boots, so I gave that up. Towards the late afternoon, the Royal Marines managed to get their 3-inch anti-aircraft guns going again. Now, this brought down a particular hate. The terrific air attack was brought in on the hill, and they strafed and they bombed, and they set fire to the whole of the top of the hill. All the undergrowth and the stores and everything else were all burning. And so dusk fell with me being pinned down by a sniper with a great big conflagration of fire behind me. And then a messenger came round saying, withdraw at the top of the hill. I went up to the top of the hill, and there I joined a whole mass of people like myself, refugees from the battle, who were just gathered up there. The New Zealanders were all in their defensive positions, but on top of the hill there were everybody had been knocked out of their positions, a fair number of Royal Marines, the gunners and things and so on. And we swapped yarns and we were given a bit of supper. We were given a bacon sandwich and a cup of tea. We were really quite pleased with ourselves because it's at the end of the first day and we were still holding the hill. We'd been told to hold the hill and that was it. And then we dozed off, went to sleep. It had been agreed between Commander Beale and Andrews, Colonel Andrews, that when we withdrew to the hill, which was the plan, then it wasn't worthwhile, it wasn't feasible to withdraw to actual set positions, defended positions. Andrews, I think, didn't want, in any case, empty trenches up there in case they were used by the Germans instead of by our people. And that we would be absorbed into the New Zealand positions as we got up there. One talks about us being chased off the airfield. We weren't chased off the airfield. We withdrew from the airfield to be absorbed into the New Zealand positions as part of the plan. But it didn't work. As I've said already, when I got up there, there was no room for me in any of the trenches. So I was lying out in the open. And when we, during that night, we slept up there. And then about 2 o'clock in the morning, we were all woken up. And we were told we were going to withdraw. And I had been talking to a number of people up there. As far as I could see, I was the only officer left from the airfield. There were quite a number of men, and they all knew me. I'd been working with them for a month. And I learnt that Commander Beale had been badly wounded, and so had Squadron Leader Howell of 33 Squadron, that there had been very considerable casualties. I was told that under the intensive air attack, that most people had stayed in their trenches cowering, and they were discovered there, still sheltering, when the Germans landed. And the Germans then advanced on trenches, lobbed bombs in, and the survivors coming out and surrendering had then been used as a screen by the Germans in moving on to the New Zealand positions, and that in a number of cases the British men, the Navy and RAF, who were being used as a screen, had then run for it and had been shot in the back by the Germans, or had been indeed been shot by the New Zealanders who were trying to defend themselves from the advancing Germans. So they were in a tricky, sticky position. Anyhow, they've been very roughly handled, and a lot of them were unarmed, having been captured first of all and then possibly escaped or never having got to their arms when the invasion occurred. So, in the night, we were told at 2 o'clock we were going to withdraw. And I gathered together quite a group of the RAF chaps, and we started off. Now, it was in single file. We had a guide taking us through the German positions. We were tagging on to the chap ahead of us. It was a fairly starlit night. I didn't think it was a moon. I can't remember. Not much of a moon, anyway. And the whisper would go down the line, Germans 50 yards to the right. And we filed away from the hill, and out. I've never discovered why Colonel Andrews gave up the hill position. They'd lost the battle. He'd been ordered to stay there, quite clearly, by General Freyberg. And Andrews was a hard-bitten, fighting man. I've often wondered whether the fact that he was caught down on the airfield during the intensive air bombardment threw him off his balance. I don't know. But he withdrew from the hill. And once we got through the German positions, which were surrounding the hill, more and more men started to form up on me. And I found myself down on the coast road, which ran from Malamere Field through Malamere Village along towards Kania. And in a short space of time, I had about 120 men. And we were marching along the coast road, either side of it, in the shadow, slight shadow, you see, not in the sort of white of the dust of the Greek road. Either side, I was leading one file, and I can't remember who was leading the other file, Flight Sergeant, I think. And we were halted, and by New Zealand position. And they asked where I was going. I said, to Kania. They said, like hell you are. Germans holding the road 200 yards away, German block post. Turned back. So I turned back. And I wandered round. I wandered round from one battalion position to the other and eventually settled down in the night in the middle of the New Zealand defences. It was a shambles, but any army battle is a shambles, especially when you just retreated from the position you're meant to be holding. And so we settled down for the night, and we slept the rest of the night, which was about a couple of hours, or could, as much as we could. And in the morning, when I assessed what I got, I found that I had a very miscellaneous collection. I had some Navy, I had quite a bit of RAF, I had tank crews, tanks had been knocked out. I had Royal Marines. I had New Zealanders and Australians. There we are. So there was a bit of reorganization, and all the soldiers were taken away from me. The tank crews and the New Zealanders and the Royal Marines were reformed and put together. And I was left with the airfield personnel.
What was morale like at this stage?
Not bad, not bad. We were in the middle of the New Zealand British defences. A lot of them had been very badly, roughly handled. Especially ones that have been taken prisoner by the Germans and things. But not too bad, the morale. We had near the brigade headquarters, was where we settled down for the night. And we were given a bit of breakfast. And as we were having breakfast, there was the sound of marching feet, and their contingent swung into sight alongside along the coast road, and this was 805 Squadron. 30 men of under Lieutenant Alec Ramsay, a fighter pilot, with Lieutenant Keith, and they were magnificent. I mean, you know, he really put on a show, and deliberately. They were marching with their arms strictly at the slope, and as they came past the brigadier, Ramsay gave an eyes right, and they halted, and Ramsay came and reported to the brigadier, and gave an account of his story. Now, he and his men had not withdrawn up the hill as had been ordered to do, and indeed, I never sorted this out with him, but I think that 33 Squadron and 805 Squadron, the Hurricane and the Fleet Air Arm Fighter Squadron, had been excused that exercise on the hill because they were still operating aircraft. And so I think it was mostly the station personnel and 30th Squadron who had no aircraft, that is the former Blenheim Fighter Squadron, who had done the exercise up the hill, and that the it hadn't been a sort of automatic reaction like mine to get up the hill. Anyhow, whatever the reason, they had remained in defensive positions down near their own airfield area at the east end of the runway, and they had held it all day long against the Germans, and then through the night, and then in the morning, a very strong German attack had developed on them, and they had eventually been forced out of their positions, and they had then fallen back, and they fell back a mile along the coast before they caught up with the New Zealanders again. That's what had happened. So the whole of the New Zealand line had fallen back a mile from the edge of the airfield, in effect. And indeed, one can see the picture, really. New Zealanders have now formed a line from the coast to the foothills of the mountains in exactly the same sort of way that Andrews had described it to me in Greece, where they had fallen back during the whole of that campaign. So in that fact, I have an idea that the New Zealanders amongst themselves had decided, fuck that bloody general, this is what we're going to do. I don't know. One will never know. But this is what happened. The New Zealanders actually, Andrews abandoned the position on the hill, and they formed the defensive line from the coast to the foothills of the mountains. And that is the way that it was when Ramsay came in with his party. Now, also about this time, another contingent came and joined in. This was with a Flying Officer Crowther. He was 30 Squadron. I don't know what he was, I think he was a warrant officer. I'm not certain. Anyway, he was a very effective man. Tough, gruff chap, and a very good fighter, and but he wasn't an airman, definitely. He hadn't got wings, in fact, I think he was 30 Squadron Armament Officer, I think is what he was, he came in with a contingent of RAF and one or two Navy. Now, whereas I had made my way up the hill on the east side of the camp and of the olive grove and got up to the top, he had also done the same thing with a group of people from the west side and pulled together quite a contingent, more men than I had. I got up with about 30, he got up with about 40 or 50, 40 people up the hill, and had withdrawn, and now he came in and joined in my contingent. So we had somewhere about, I suppose about 90 RAF chaps, an RAF 412, and about 30 from Fleet Air Arm, 805 squadrons, about 120 are now built up of refugees from the airfield. There we were, swapping yarns and discussing what to do next. We weren't left in that situation very long. The brigadier said we were to get out. I was sent for by the brigade major, Major Harding. Now, I was discovered by this stage, I was a senior surviving officer from the airfield. As a naval lieutenant, everybody else above me disappeared. And so I was the senior surviving officer, and I was sent for by the brigade major, who said that this group of non-combatants in the middle of the battle was bad for morale. They wanted us out. And that they would provide guides and take us through the German lines to Kamia that night. That was it. We then had a discussion of the officers. I was told also that the Royal Marines would go with us because they were required at Ceuta Bay to reform there with other Royal Marines. And that's what I had. So the Royal Marines, the whole of the airfield contingent. There was the Lieutenant Royal Marines in charge of the Royal Marine contingent. Then there were the various naval officers, and I think there were a couple of body of officers. There was Crowther and one other, I think. That's all that were left. All the rest have been captured or killed. And we decided that what we'd do would be to the Royal Marines would form an advance guard, that the unarmed party, which was about 40 or 50 men, would be under Crowther, that I would be in charge of the armed party of RAF, which comprised about 40 people, and that Ramsay would form a rear guard with his 30 people from 805 Squadron. And then we would go march through the night like that and make our way to Kania, guided by the New Zealanders. That was fine. Now, we had a bit of a problem. You asked about earlier about morale. We had a bit of a problem persuading these people that this was the thing to do. They felt safe in the middle of the New Zealanders, but the idea of another night march through the night and being taken past the German positions and things didn't appeal to them at all. And we had quite a job persuading them that this was the safest and best thing to do, to get out of the battle and to get out of the front line. We told the men that they would be marching all night, get a rest if they could, get sleep, and that we settled down. And then in the fairly latish afternoon, when we were about to start forming up and getting away, or about half an hour before we decided to form up and get away, the brigade major sent for me again and said that their losses had been very heavy, that they were going to have to shorten their line, and that we, the airfield personnel, would have to provide a platoon on the left and a platoon on the right to strengthen them. Well, again, we had a meeting of the officers, and we decided that at this late stage, to try and detail so many men to a platoon on the right and a platoon on the left was impracticable. We'd spent the afternoon.